Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and this is our Summer Reading List special episode. Our final conversation is with Tony-nominated actor Andrew Rannells. In his new book, Too Much Is Not Enough, a memoir of fumbling toward adulthood, Andrew shares his coming-of-age story, from being a theater kid in Omaha, Nebraska, to landing his first Broadway role in Hairspray. Although he went on to be nominated for a Tony for originating the role of Elder Price in the Book of Mormon and stole a scene or two as Elijah on the HBO show Girls, Andrew Rannells' path to honest-to-goodness success was filled with cringy auditions and self-doubt. I began our chat with Andrew by asking why he chose to go all the way back to his childhood for the book and to mine his early life rather than focus on his life after he became famous. Take a listen.
Your career sort of starts with like your largest achievement, but all of the time before that, that I was in New York, that all mattered, that all kept me here. And you know, the Broadway fans, like the young fans, are very enthusiastic and very loyal and very enthusiastic. And I would see these kids at the stage door, and sometimes they would, you know, they never said shortcut, but it was always implied, like, how do I do it?
How do you and how do I?
And the answer is there isn't a shortcut. Like, you have to go through all of that stuff. And, you know, a lot of the jobs that I talk about in this book are, you know, not things that anyone knew that I did, or maybe not that like fun or fancy, but they all sort of kept me on the right path. They all kept me active and motivated, and they're in a lot of ways is equally important as the, you know, as the Book of Mormon. It was the Westchester Broadway Dinner Theater. It was like equally important. So I wanted to share those stories because I feel like sometimes those are the wins that are not as celebrated, mm-hmm. but are equally important.
When you sat down and finally said, okay, I'm going to do this, and you decided you wanted to write this, how did you go about it practically?
I mean, I was sort of tricked into it. My friend Bill Clegg, who is a very talented writer and also my literary agent, I was just sending him essays and sort of short stories, and he was giving me notes, and I was just sort of working on like the craft of writing, I guess. And then he was like, you know, I think I would like to send one of these to Dan Jones at the Times, who edits the Modern Love column, and I was like, well, that seems like kind of a long shot, but okay. And he sent it, and Dan responded very positively and published an essay about a year and a half ago. At that time, then I had like a handful of essays already written. So when there was interest, you know, has he written anything else? Does he have anything else to read? Like, I had like 10 more essays to show. So Bill tricked me. He tricked me into writing a book. But it was, I found the process to be, I really liked it. It's very solitary, but it's, mm-hmm. I don't know, it's probably the most fulfilling thing I've ever worked on.
Completely truthfully, did you get a little drunk with happy when you saw your names in the New York Times?
100%. I mean, when you see, like, there's a cartoon, like a little cartoon of me with next to that essay, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, is this happening? Is this a real thing?
So, you know, at one point, I'm going to get into details in the book, but I'm curious, at one point, after you've handed in your first manuscript and your editor comes back with notes, what was something that you didn't necessarily realize either about your life or about your writing that your editor recognized?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I was maybe initially too forthcoming. I maybe shared too much. Too much actually is enough, it turns out. So there were times where Matt Inman, my publisher, my editor was like, maybe we don't need all the details. Maybe pull back on some of those things. Which was, I mean, it was learning to self-edit was an important skill, because I just sort of vomited out, like, everything. And he was like, maybe we don't need all of that. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, particularly with relationship, I mean, I'm dealing with a very specific time in one's life, and, you know, mostly like early 20s, where you do just sort of, I mean, I lived hard and loved hard. And like, I made a lot of, I wouldn't even say mistakes. I just like made bold choices. I made very bold choices.
How glad are you there wasn't the internet? I think about that.
Jeez. I mean,
my 20s and 30s.
Truly. We were just talking. I was talking with friends of mine about like the lack of photos from that time. And it really is a gift because I'm glad. I'm glad we didn't all have cell phones that we were taking pictures of, because, well, I don't really need to see
that. Didn't need to see that.
Yeah, I don't need to see that.
My guest is Andrew Rannells. We're talking about his new memoir, Too Much Is Not Enough. So you're from Omaha, Nebraska.
Yes.
What impact did growing up in Omaha have on you? You kind of don't realize it at the time, but then when you leave and you go someplace, you realize, wow, this is very Nebraskan about me, or I behave this way because I grew up there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Midwestern sort of like pluck that I certainly have. And then I'm, you know, for a while I fought, you know, when you get to New York, and I felt very out of place, and I felt very I felt like I needed to be something that maybe I wasn't. So it took me many years to just embrace the fact that I'm not from here. I've chosen to live here, and I want to make this my home, but I was born someplace else, and that's okay. I don't need to try to fake my way as a native New Yorker, because I'm not. So I embrace the fact that I'm from the Midwest, and I'm proud of that. It's like it's a great place to be from, and I think that my parents definitely instilled a really solid work ethic in me that I'm very grateful for, and that when I was younger, I sort of brushed it off as like a cheesiness or like an earnestness that I wasn't always proud of, but I am proud of it. I am proud of it.
What does Midwestern pluck look like? What does that look like also in New York?
Like me. I mean, that's why it was like when I initially auditioned for The Book of Mormon, and Trey Parker said to me later, he was like, you walked in and you were like, he was like, I just could tell you were from the Midwest. I guess it looks like me. I'm not sure.
Sort of open and friendly.
Yes,
there's a
positive positivity to it, but also there's a you know, those pioneer people, Willa Cather, she's a strong lady. So I feel like that's definitely in my blood, that like those prairie people who came there to like start a new life, and like there's a hardiness mm-hmm. to that I feel like also lends itself well to coming to New York City, because this is obviously not the easiest city to live in and to start a career in. And you do have to have a certain amount of focus and backbone to make that work.
You make no bones about it. You knew as a kid you were destined to perform. You did it all the time. So how did your parents react when they realized they had this kid who was singularly focused, like just wanted to be out there?
They did not know what to do with me. But my mother did. She had the sense to just put me in like acting classes at this children's theater called the Emmy Gifford Children's Theater. It was right near her home. So every Saturday, they just sort of like dropped me off at this theater. And that was how I got my, you know, my fix. They definitely were not stage parents. They didn't know from this world. So they like, they just sort of let me figure it out, which was very helpful. And, you know, in some ways, I wish they had been around maybe a little bit more, but they didn't know. I mean, it was like it's a strange hobby to all of a sudden have a kid who was like wanted to be an actor in Omaha, Nebraska. Like, what the hell does that? What does that look like?
And you're one of five, right?
One of five.
So, where are you in the birth order? Second.
Four.
Number four.
Number four.
Do you believe in birth order?
I mean, I think it has
to. Your personality?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, it definitely informs how you interact with people. Like, I'm not the baby, but sometimes act like it. And my parents were understandably, you know, sort of checked out by the time.
It's a lot of them.
It's a lot of kids. So, like, you know, my younger sister and I, you know, were babysat by a television a lot of the time because, like, you know, they were tired. Five kids is a lot.
It's a lot.
Who would do that to themselves?
That's a lot.
It's a lot of children.
I admire anyone who takes on that. I guess it's Andrew Reynolds. The name of his book is Too Much Is Not Enough. There's this great passage you write about your brother. And your brother and kind of enjoying the fact that you were considered a ladies' man for a while in school.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to read this passage on page 66.
Oh, dear. All right. All right. If the gym was where I started to get other guys to accept me, it was the school dances where I sealed the deal. I was a good dancer by mid-90s standards, meaning I could grind. I watched Eric Nice religiously, and I still have a soft spot in my heart for the song Pony by Genuine. That's when I started to get a reputation for being a ladies' man. It made me uncomfortable because it was a lie, but it also made things easier for me at school. I don't know why my classmates thought I was having sex with these girls, but somehow that became the rumor. I could tell it pleased my brother. I'm sure he was nervous for me walking into the testosterone-fueled zoo that was our high school, but now his little brother had the reputation of being a real slut. Lucky him and me.
How long did you let that go, that rumor?
I mean, all through high school.
Yeah.
I didn't come out until... I went to an all-boys Catholic school. I didn't come out until after I graduated, like the summer that I graduated. That's when I told my family. It just wasn't... It was 1997. It was not like a... I couldn't... It didn't feel like a safe space to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So with your... That's just funny that your brother was just so into it.
Well, he was a senior.
Have you talked about it since?
Yeah. I mean, he was a senior when I was a freshman, and I think he was worried. Like, here I was this, like... you know, theater nerd who was going to this all-boys school. And I'm sure he was concerned. And then all of a sudden I was very popular with girls because I could dance well and I never touched them. So I was very respectful. I was a very respectful date.
You write about your mom and your grandma having a big influence on your life.
Very much so.
What was something that each of them taught you that you still carry with you?
My mom really taught me, and my grandmother too, that like you can be kind, but not be a pushover. Which I think that sometimes people who, you know, my mother is a very like friendly, open person, and I think sometimes that can be taken as like that person is inconsequential in some ways. But they are both very strong people. So I learned that from her, that you can be nice, but it doesn't mean that you're a pushover. You can also have, you know, some strength behind that, but it doesn't cost you anything to be kind. Mm-hmm. But it also doesn't mean you have to be taken advantage of.
And I thought your grandmother was the queen of shade.
Oh my God, she was so shady. Josephine. Josephine was so shady. And I mean, I love her. I loved her. But she was real shady. I mean, you realize like how much, like I was writing this, I was like, wow, they really talked a lot of, you know, she had a lot of opinions
of
a lot of people.
Well, you're searching for the words that I can say on public radio.
I know. Did you see me self-edit
yes,
there?
Very
there
good.
There we go.
Well done. My guest is Andrew Reynolds. The name of his book is Too Much Is Not Enough, a memoir of fumbling toward adulthood. We'll have more with Andrew after a quick break. Welcome back. My guest is Tony-nominated actor Andrew Reynolds. Maybe you know him from the Broadway production of Hairspray and the Book of Mormon, or from HBO's Girls or Showtime's Black Monday. This hour, Andrew and I are talking about his memoir published this spring. It's called Too Much Is Not Enough, a memoir of fumbling toward adulthood. In part two of our conversation, I began by asking Andrew about the experience of coming out to his parents, which he did just a week before he moved from his home in Nebraska to New York City with the goal of making it as an actor.
Everyone who comes out, like, there's a little piece of your head that's like, but what if there is a problem? Like, what if they don't respond well? So I waited, even though I had known my whole life that this was the case, I waited until about a week before I moved, just in case, yeah. Just in case there was a problem. And there wasn't. It was fine. But it did, you know, probably cause a little more tension. It was new information that we all had then. And
was it new to them, do you think?
No, God. No. I mean, my father did the very sort of typical thing that I think a lot of parents say, which was... Or at least, you know, he said to me, he was like, well, I don't think you need to be this way, but if you're choosing to be this way, I still love you. And which hurt because, it's not a choice. And then about 6 months later, I was home visiting and he said, you know, I've been thinking about it. And I remember when you were five, you wanted to be a solid gold dancer. So I realize now it was not a choice. This is the way you were born. So he did.
Actually very sweet.
Yes, it was very sweet.
It's actually very sweet.
Very happy that he came to the point where he was like, oh, yeah, this is actually. Because I really did. I mean, I wanted to be a solid gold dancer. It was like my first dream job. So I think my father was like, okay.
Danny Terrio was entrancing.
Hell yeah. Adrian's Med. I mean, yeah.
So when you came here, you came to go to college.
Yes.
What was that push and pull like? I think a lot of young actors have that, like, I'm in school, but I want to be auditioning, but I'm in school.
It's a tricky thing. Like, it was very hard. It was very appealing to have the access to auditions. I mean, I was auditioning for Broadway shows within a month of moving here. So obviously I was skipping school to, like, right. to start auditioning for stuff. I don't know. I mean, I do tell people who, young people who ask about colleges, like, New York is not for everyone. And, you know, in reality, perhaps I should have gone someplace first to go to school. But the appeal of just, like, living life in the city was too great for me. So I just, like, I ended up dropping out of college and just started working because it's right here. It's right here. So I was like, I might as well try it. And there is the question, too, like, is this degree, like, what is this actually, what am I buying? Mm-hmm. What am I paying for? Is this going to, does this, it doesn't guarantee me a job. Is it actually make, is it going to make me better? Is it going to, and the, you know, the answer for me was I got a job and I just started working. And I think that was a good education for me, but I might have done it differently.
So much of the story, the book, story, it's your life, not a story. So much of your life and the story you tell of your life is about friendships and mm-hmm. about relationships. And you have this friend and her name is Susanna.
Yes.
It got sort of Ellis Islandized for a while, yeah, right?
Her parents called her Susan for a while. Yes.
But Susanna is much more.
It's her name, you know, yeah.
It's also glamorous.
It's very glamorous.
So why was she such an important person to you when you think back to that?
She was the first person that I met who wanted the same thing I did. So it, you know, 18 when we met at a college scholarship audition, this program called the Young Arts. And she was from Fort Wayne. I was from Nebraska. We met there. She was the first person that I met who wanted this, had the same dream that I had and was actually willing to do it. She was also moving to New York. She was going to Barnard. She was gonna do it. And that was the first person that I met who also, like, unabashedly said out loud, like, that's what I want to. We're gonna go get that together. Mm-hmm. And it was really exciting to have someone that I could just be shameless about that. Like, I have ambition and that's okay. And not, I didn't want to apologize for it. You know, you find yourself sometimes apologizing for ambition or mm-hmm. apologizing for dreams or being like, well, this is silly, but this is what I want. But she wanted the same thing I did, and we could just say it out loud.
Were you afraid to say it out loud?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was, because it felt too, it was too big. It's too big. Mm-hmm. It's too big to say, like, I want to be on Broadway. That seemed shameful. And I had teachers and things along the way that were like, but what do you really want to do? What do you actually want to do? Like, no, that's the thing I want to do. I want to be on Broadway. And I think it got drilled into my head that, like, that was somehow unacceptable to just say that out loud.
Well, you and Susanna both coming from the Midwest to New York. You have a great passage I'm going to ask you to read.
Sure.
That describes what it's like to come to New York and who you think you should be. It's on, I'm going to say, there's, you'll see the word I crossed out because you can't say it on radio. You can start with My Dreams. This is Andrew Reynolds reading from his memoir, Too Much Is Not Enough.
Why do I get nervous reading something that I wrote? It's like I wrote this, so I should be fine reading
it,
but here we go. My dreams of living in New York went beyond Broadway and the appeal of wearing all black clothing. I wanted the whole lifestyle that came with being a New Yorker. I wanted to walk into a deli with my MoMA tote bag, complain about subway service intelligently, and order myself a regular coffee, understanding exactly what I was getting. That's milk and two sugars. But perhaps most of all, I wanted to be a cultured person in the way I perceived New Yorkers to be. I wanted to go to art galleries and performance installations and plays that were staged in abandoned storefronts. My partner in this exploration was always Susanna. We were young artists. We were living in New York City now. There were experiences to be had. There was art to be seen, and we were going to find it. After years of being limited to community theater productions and big screen blockbusters in the Midwest, we were hungry for darker fare. We wanted to be challenged. In short, we wanted to see some weird stuff. I self-edited.
Thank you again.
You're
for
welcome.
Self-editing. Have you ever realized that yet, or is that still something that's a fan in your head?
No, I mean I do feel like, yeah, I feel like I've done it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm doing it, I mm-hmm. guess. Yeah. I mean, the great part about living here is taking advantage of the city, right? Of doing all of the things that there are to do here. So and in some ways, I think that that's, you know, coming from someplace else, like, I could see it very clearly, like, mm-hmm. all of the opportunities and all of the information that's in front of you that you get to take in. So, yeah, I feel like I'm doing it.
Angie mentioned at the top of the interview, for anybody who's just tuning in now, that, you know, it's the book doesn't start or really include any of your huge, great success. It talks about all the hard work along the way and all the summer stock you had to do and
summer
all
stock.
The different kind of performances in strange places. Is there one story you think you can share that really sort of embodies what that experience was like, those rungs on the ladder?
I mean, the one that pops out is that I was in the touring production of Pokemon Live, which was a very dark time in my life. Pokemon Live.
You guys drank a lot. You're right.
Oh, my God. We drank a lot. Pokemon Live, you know, Pokemon is a cartoon and some sort. I don't know what it's like a card game. I'm not sure. It was a video game. I have no idea.
It was turned into a show.
But they turned it into a live show that we did at Radio City Music Hall. And then we took on like a small tour throughout the States. And yeah, that was tough. That's paying your dues is when you're in Pokemon Live.
And what did you play in Pokemon Live?
I played one of the villains. There's a duo called Team Rocket, and their names are Jesse and James, and I played James, and it was very informative. It was a gay clown part. It was like a very over the top gay clown, and I didn't want to do it, and I thought it was sort of offensive. I thought the voice and all of it, but I needed a job. So
yeah.
I did it.
You had that interesting sort of moment of, do I want to do this? Because it leans into so many hard stereotypes. You hear Indian American actors talk about this a lot. But at the same time, you're a working actor. You need a check. You need something on your resume.
Know.
That's a tough choice.
It was tough, I don't regret it because it was a good lesson, particularly in just like saving money, quite frankly, of like, don't put yourself in that position. Mm-hmm. I needed that job to live, but I was like, after that, I never want to put myself in that position to have to take a job. Because sometimes as an actor, the only power you have is to say no. So you say no to auditions, you can say no to offers. Like, that's sometimes it. Because once you're in it, you just got to do it. So that's when I first learned that lesson.
You did check out for a while.
I did check
you
out.
You did. You said, you know what, I'm not sure this is going to be for me. This was a great dream. I've exercise it a bit, and I'm going to get a job as a temp and figure out.
Yeah, I ended up working for the people who make Pokemon. Actually, I worked for this company called 4Kids Entertainment, and I directed animation for like 2.5 years. And weirdly, the audition that set me over the edge was Hairspray. I got very close to getting it. I did not get it. And then I was like, I'm leaving the business. I can't do this. It was just too much. I like had my heart broken like too many times. And I was like, I just can't do it anymore. And then strangely, 2.5 years later, that was the audition that came back around. That I was like, you know what? I think it's time to tackle that. Let's tackle those fears and get back in there. And then it worked out 2 years later.
During those 2 years, what did you think about a lot?
I tried to ignore the fact that I was not doing the thing that I came here to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it felt like kind of a win that I was still here. It's not like I moved. I mean, I could have moved back to Nebraska, but I didn't. I stayed. But in some ways that was worse because I stayed and I still wasn't doing the thing that I came here to do. So it was a strange time. I mean, I was distracted by work. I had a boyfriend that I loved very much. Like I was... You know, I was living, but there was always something in the back of my mind that was like, you're not doing the thing you said you were going to do.
You mentioned that you had a steady boyfriend at the time. Did you come to New York also to find love? Did you decide this was going to be the place where you were going to have your great love?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because I had sort of a rough entry into sexual life, it seemed like a clean slate. And I found very quickly found a very dreamy, dumb boyfriend in college that was like very appropriate for 19, just like a handsome dummy.
Mm-hmm.
That was great. And he he looked like Jordan Catalano. And I thought I was winning. I was like, this is success. I found like a emo-y boyfriend. I live in New York. I'm done.
But you weren't. You needed to have that big break. You needed to find that. Do you consider Hairspray your big break?
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's another part of why I focused on this particular time in my life was because that was that was my big success. My dream was to be on Broadway. It was quickly, you know, I was so grateful to achieve it, and I was very happy for a very long time just having that dream. And of course, as we've all learned from Oprah, sometimes when you achieve a dream, then the next thing is to dream a different dream or a mm-hmm. bigger dream, and that's what I did. I sort of traded up and imagined something else, and but for a long time I was very happy to be in the chorus of a Broadway show because that's what I wanted to do. That's what I came here to do. So I was thrilled, and that was the win. I got it. So you know, I think that, you know, the Book of Mormon obviously was also a big win and a dream come true, but my initial dream was a little smaller. It was a smaller dream.
That's why I like the way the book, that's kind of where you end up. It doesn't have to be the Oscar being the dream.
No.
Like, I did the thing that I've been thinking about since I was five and pretending to be on Solid Gold. I get to be on Broadway.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It's so interesting. So let's talk about a couple of the big wins in our last couple of minutes.
Sure, sure.
Of everything you've done on Broadway, what's the one that sort of blows your mind, blows your 15-year-old brain that you got to do?
Well, performing on the Tonys with the Book of Mormon was like, you know, that was insane. I mean, that was my access point to Broadway with the Tony Awards, you know, pre-internet. Like, that was the mm-hmm. one time of year where you got to see things on Broadway, where it was the Tony broadcast. So getting to do that was unbelievable. So that will always be the closest to my heart. Doing falsettos on Broadway was also, because again, seeing that on the Tony Awards as a kid and then getting to be in that revival was something that I never thought would happen. And working with James Lapine, it was that was a real dream come true.
It was such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.